You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome to Professor Peter Shane. Professor Peter Shane is a visiting professor of law this year at the Harvard Law School, and he is the Jacob E. Davis and the Jacob E. Davis Chair in Law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. He's also the author of this report, Forming Communities, Sustaining Democracy in the Digital Age, of which there are a couple of copies here for available for people to take if they'd like. And I'd just like to welcome him. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you all for coming. I should say, the report's now going like hotcakes, if you can see this on the web. It's also available online at www.nightcom, with two M's, for nightcommission.org. And I have more hard copies for free in my office. I was just too weak to carry them all. So this is just a way of luring some of you to visit me individually while I'm here at Harvard. It's great to be a visitor here for a year, not least because it's given me some wonderful opportunities to interact with some of the fellows and students and faculty affiliated with the Berkman Center, which is just an extraordinary resource. And, people always ask what it's like to visit Harvard, and I always say, great students, great colleagues, and occasionally free lunch. What more can you ask? So today I want to report on a line of inquiry in which I've been involved. I always feel it's a little odd in this crowd, although maybe less so given that we're here at Harvard Law School. But I'm not a technologist. I'm not really a social scientist, although I may play one on television occasionally. I'm a constitutional lawyer by trade. And the way I got into the subject we're talking about is that early in the 90s, smart friends of mine told me that if I had any hope of saying sensible, much less compelling things about the future of democracy in the course of my academic career, I ought to learn something about communications. And one thing leading to another, I became particularly interested in what was the then emerging practice of some governments around the world to use what was then called the internet, we would now say new media, to engage everyday citizens more directly in actual public policymaking. And that work actually led to my being asked to work on the report, free copies of which have gone around. This is a report of the Knight Commission on the Information Needs of Communities in a Democracy. The report was actually not about this subject of online consultation very much. What happened is the Knight Foundation, the folks with journalism money from the Knight Brothers newspapers, down in Miami, gave a big grant to a think tank in D.C. called the Aspen Institute to create a commission of luminaries from around the country, of whom I was not one. I was not a member of the commission. I was just the executive director. But they were supposed to ask what the head of the Knight Foundation, a wonderful visionary man named Alberto Abarguin, said were three straightforward questions. And I always smile when I remember him describing these as straightforward questions, because I can hardly imagine three more complicated questions. But the questions are, what are the information needs of communities in a democracy? Are those needs being met in the United States? And if not, what should we do about it? And I was just being in the right place at the right time. I was asked to be executive director, which really meant research coordinator, for the commission. Amar described me as the author of the report. I was really the team lead for a group of drafters trying to come up with a collective statement that all 17 members of the commission would subscribe to. The way in which the commission has fed into my thinking about the topic today will be clear a few slides down the road. The more immediate project that brings me here is a book that MIT just published called Connecting Democracy, Online Consultation and the Flow of Political Communication. And this book resulted from a collaboration between Stephen Coleman at the University of Leeds and myself, along with 17 other researchers from 7 different countries, asking collectively the question, under what circumstances and in what ways will the practice of online consultation deepen democratic practice? And again, by online consultation, what I'm referring to is government sponsorship or government support for efforts to use new media to engage the public more directly in policymaking. The book covers a lot of territory. Those of you who do political communication, besides Stephen Coleman, who probably knows more about this subject than anybody else in the world, you know, would probably also recognize as contributors Andy Chadwick from London and Vince Price from the University of Pennsylvania. But it was a wonderful group, and it was exciting to work with them. So the starting point, in a way, for thinking about this is a kind of vision of what a perfect world of democratic communication might look like. A world in which, just everyday folks, we would all have all of the skills we need, the technological capacities we need, opportunities to engage, motivations to engage with information in ways that are that connect us to civic space. We would have a wonderfully transparent government that makes it easy to track its activities. We would have a thriving civil society that, again, took advantage of new technologies for political mobilization, for information creation, distribution. And we would have effective intermediaries. It used to be called journalists, I think. People who, since most of us, I would say all of us, none of us, has the capacity to try to imbibe in a relatively unmediated way all of the information that could be useful to us about every conceivable thing we're interested in, we always rely on other people to act as intermediaries, and sometimes they're professionally trained and sometimes not, and sometimes that's relevant and sometimes not. But if all of these things come together in this perfect world, we would have what I called in an essay I wrote once, democratic information communities, communities in which information is kind of circulating in ways that promote the 4 activities I mentioned on the slide: coordination, accountability, problem solving, and connectedness. That is, these are the things actually that the Knight Commission took to be the needs that are served in communities by information: the ability to coordinate, to enable everybody to know how to get done what they need to get done or want to get done most effectively, accountability, sort of self-explanatory, problem solving. And by connectedness, we mean sharing the information that leads groups of people to develop some kind of common narrative within which they understand what they're doing as fellow citizens within a roughly contiguous geographic space. So the question is, so we don't live in this world. Right, this ideal world doesn't exist. Although, oddly enough, all of the tools, all of the technological tools that we need have already been invented. It's not that we need some magical networking thing that nobody has thought of yet, we don't have a way to proliferate vast amounts of information very cheaply. All of this stuff exists technologically, but we don't live there. And so the question is, under what circumstances would institutions and practices develop that would take us in that direction? And in particular, for this book, how far can online consultation go in creating the more perfect world? Now, for some of you, this may be very, very familiar, but just to say this quickly, online consultations can take many different forms. So what's on the slide now behind me is a slide from something called the Center for Deliberative Democracy out in Stanford. It is run by a political scientist named Jim Fishkin, who created a process called deliberative polling, which is a sort of structured conversation among kind of randomly selected members of the public, a few hundred at a time, who get together to try to answer the question, what would a representative sample of the public think about some policy question if given the opportunity actually to study it and talk to one another about it? And that the deliberative polling model has an online version. So that would be one way to go. And that's a relatively complicated conversational process. Other processes that are available, probably more familiar, are just discussion forums. You've undoubtedly seen these. There are various kinds of simulator-based surveys. I was in an Anglophilic moment when I downloaded these. So these happens to be slides with English examples, but I think both New York and Maine have recently adopted budget simulator applications that you can play with online. There are mapping technologies. There are solicitations of email comments. Now the online consultation business has picked up in the United States. As of a few years ago, much more of this activity was going outside the United States. And not surprisingly, the European Union was a leader in conducting these online consultations because, in a way, the internet seemed an obvious tool to address what was widely perceived as the potential problem of democracy deficit, people living at a yet greater distance from where the people are making regulations that govern their lives. I remember hearing an NPR interview shortly before, Poland joined the EU and said, and they were talking to, a man on the street in Warsaw who said, this is great. He really looked forward to having a different life, not being controlled anymore from the Kremlin, now being controlled from Brussels. So if you go to a website called Your Voice in Europe, they will permit you, they enable you, using any of 23 languages, to participate in a set of ongoing consultations on public policy topics that they have linked to this website. Coincidentally, there are 23 languages. There were 23 ongoing consultations the last time I looked, but that was just a coincidence. In the United States, perhaps the most ambitious form of online consultation is a thing called regulation.gov. This is a website that is advertised. The hope behind it doesn't always work perfectly, but the hope behind it is that anyone can go to this website. You don't need to know anything about the structure of the government, just the existence of the website. Type in the keywords of something you care about, disability access and transportation, or energy savings, and it will tell you all of the regulatory activity that is currently proposed within the federal government concerning that topic and give you links to where you can add your comments to the discussion. Federal agencies are required by law with regard to most significant regulations to solicit public comment. They now virtually all do it online, and this is supposedly a one-stop shop for this. So when I started working in this area in the 90s, I would say the first generation of research was hugely influenced by the German philosopher and communications theorist Jürgen Habermas, who had described in his work a very influential set of norms for a kind of ideal democratic communication space called the public sphere. And researchers who were looking at this early on were basically asking the question, well, are there circumstances under which online consultation can or help approximate the ideal conditions of democratic deliberation as spelled out in Habermasian theory, which would mean a set of communication practices in which citizens sort of set their own agenda, they make political decisions without being unduly influenced by the power of the state or unequal economic power. Again, in this ideal space, reason rather than mere assertion dominates. The participants in the discussion reflect on and call to account their own deliberative practices. And citizens, again in this deliberative space, understand and take on the perspectives of their fellow citizens and express themselves sincerely under conditions of equality and inclusion. Now that's a pretty high bar to jump, and this one project, I spent a few years at the public policy school at Carnegie Mellon, and one sort of good news project that I got to work on, again, I was not at all the lead social scientist on this, but we were able to build an online environment and test it under very controlled conditions that at least led us to the conclusion that it was possible to create online deliberative spaces that participants viewed as positively as they viewed face-to-face deliberation. So again, the problem isn't technology. The problem is something else. And there are many something else's that could be listed. Again, on the slide I've just put up, there's a kind of legacy of attitudes, individual preferences, and expectations that we as citizens have formed from living in a largely non-participatory media world, which discourages political engagement, including doubts about our own political efficacy. There are a variety of kinds of digital divides. There are gaps in knowledge, opinion, and influence that separate various kinds of elites from groups of citizens, and those gaps may actually be exacerbated by gaps in media opportunity. The bureaucrats, the policymakers, the civil society organizations, the citizens, all of whom have a stake in this, may operate from different incentives. They want different things out of the process that lead them to push in different directions. A truly big problem is just conceptual uncertainty, how to integrate organic participatory communication into representative structures. That's been a hard nut to crack. In a society like ours, as in Europe, you have the problem of linguistic diversity. There turn out to be legal uncertainties about how to structure these forums in different jurisdictions. Of course, this, although I've said the technologies have been invented, if you want to create a trusted online spaces for public deliberation, you are talking about having enough government resources available to produce spaces that are widely promoted, fairly moderated, honestly summarized, and get formal responses from government bodies. And all of that does take time and energy and money. And of course, one possibility is that, governments may not have the kind of democratic intentionality that would support this kind of project. But there's a lot of writing that was done on the potential for new technologies to bring us to the Habermasian public sphere. A lot of doubts expressed about that. If you read stuff in the early 80s, there's a kind of literature that suggested give out enough laptops and all ills of democracy will be cured. And by the end of the 90s, it was give out enough laptops and we'll all be involuntary citizens of a surveillance state. And so we're trying to get past the kind of technological determinism to get to a more realistic picture. So one thing that the new book does is try to reframe the debate a bit. I have behind me a diagram that a graduate student I ran into giving a talk about this gave me. I love this diagram. I found nobody else who does. But there's this. We've tried desperately on the Knight Commission. We can never reach consensus on this. Is how to try to diagram what would be a healthy information ecology for a community. I mean, this is obviously a complex system. The question is, how does information move around in ways that translate inputs into all of the good things we want information to help with? Good problem solving, public accountability of those in power, effective coordination, a sense of connectedness. And obviously, everybody's got a stake in this. Skills count. Technological access counts, openness and transparency counts, but whether or not this is the right diagram, I guess the point that I want to make is, and the way we tried to reframe this is, so the way in which information moves through a community does involve a complex system, and maybe the question to ask about online consultations is not, do they lead to the Habermasian public sphere, but in what ways could they affect this kind of complex community ecology? So that's the question of the book. I want to say now something, just a few preliminary things about the Obama administration and its enthusiasm, its greater enthusiasm for the use of online consultations. And again, my thoughts about this are just preliminary, but I'm hoping that this will help seed our conversation about what this all means for democracy, for communication, for the democratic health of communities. As you may be aware, on his very first day in office, his first full day, the president issued a memorandum on openness and transparency that directed OMB to issue a directive on creating more open, more transparent government and to require of all federal agencies implementation plans. And they set out kind of early on to use a number of tools kind of right off the bat to model what could be done. So with regard to the drafting of the this memorandum, which itself took about 11 months, the White House sponsored a kind of three-stage online consultation, the first stage of which was come and tell us your ideas. And as it turns out, not all the ideas looked wonderful. If you may not be able to read the slide behind me, but one of the ideas was birthers misspelled not so crazy after all, spelled as one word after all. But in any event, the White House took these thousands of contributions and narrowed them down to what they thought were the most promising contributions, and they then had the public engage in a more focused discussion of those ideas, which led to a kind of further whittling down, and then an actual use of a wiki to collaboratively offer drafts of various parts of the Open Government Directive. Now, it's very hard, obviously, in this experience to trace out whether anything that's in the Open Government Directive owes its existence solely or primarily or even in part to what came up through that experience, although it is easy enough to find strong linguistic resemblances between provisions that are in the Open Government Directive and what was being discussed as part of this sort of open consultation. At the same time, or roughly around the same time, the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House had an online consultation about declassification policy. And again, this consultation was somewhat more structured. It didn't get as many thousands of contributions. But again, this doesn't prove causality, but you can see resemblances between some of the suggestions that came up with regard to classification as part of the consultation and what was actually drafted. The FCC, when it was doing the National Broadband Plan, used an application called IdeaScale to solicit people's ideas for the National Broadband Plan, have people vote on that. You can still see the results at broadband.gov. And the latest of these initiatives is something called We the People, which is a petitioning site that is sponsored by the White House, inspired, I assume, by something that Tony Blair did called 10 Downing Street. Now, this may be apocryphal, but my understanding is that 10 Downing Street didn't go very well, in part because the first petition to generate the appropriate thousands of names was a petition to stop the Labor government from creating a series of toll roads. And that led to everybody who signed the petition getting an email from the Prime Minister explaining that they didn't really understand the issue, which turned out not to be a great, you know, democratic moment in terms of popular mobilization. And the White House has not done that. So the way it operates, there is a set of ground rules. Among the most important are the sort of threshold numbers for getting reactions. So for a post to be searchable within whitehouse.gov, a petition that you put up has to get 150 signatures within a month. And if you now get 25,000 signatures within a month, then you will get an official response. There'll be a meeting of a White House group to decide who should be the responder, and that responder or group of responders will provide the response. They originally set the threshold at 5,000. They realized that was, or it occurred to them that this was going to lead to a lot of meetings to respond, so they changed it within in about 2 weeks to 25,000. Now, there were also a set of, there's a terms of agreement. There's an agreement on terms of use here. Petitions on the site have to fall within the scope of the site. That is, they have to seek federal government actions or policies on the topics that are included within the platform. The terms of use say no threats of unlawful violence or harm to any individual or group, no obscene, vulgar, or lewd material, no defamatory or vulgar statements. There are a few others like that. And I have to say that one reason why the United States was slow to have these kinds of consultations is because if a government at pretty much any level thought about doing this, there would be a lawyer in the room saying, the First Amendment won't allow us to moderate this. And apparently more sober opinions have ruled. And the thought is that as long as the regulations are viewpoint neutral, that is, people can speak on any side of an issue, that having reasonable what we might call time, place, and manner restrictions does not violate the First Amendment. So, early impressions. This initiative was launched on September 22nd of last fall, and as of February 9th, there were 45 petitions that had received responses, many of which got to the 5,000 signature mark prior to October 3rd and were answered based on that threshold, even though they didn't ever get to 25,000. A research assistant of mine, a grade 3L here at Harvard named Leo Delgado, has gone through these, and by his count, he found that basically 19 of the 45 got what might be considered a relatively negative or no response. Two petitions asked for things that the federal government can't do. I take it they're beyond federal power. Eight basically said, We feel you, we understand your concern, but we disagree. Either we're not prepared to go ahead because of basic policy disagreement, or we don't think we have the data yet to proceed. And nine said, we can't really comment on that because what you're asking us to do is something that would be either legally, either be unlawful or inappropriate for us to do. So that left 45 minus 19, 26 responses that tended to take this form. Either we share your concern and here's what we propose to do about it. Actually, we've already acted upon this, but we are urging Congress and others to get involved. And the third is we can't do exactly what you proposed, but we do share your concern. Here's what we've done in this area already and what we would like to do further. Now, and so this is, 45 petitions is not necessarily a broad, scientifically sound sample, but at least gives us a flavor for the kinds of responses. These responses pose the question, obviously, is an exercise like this worth it? Is it meaningful in a democratic sense? And there's been a lot of debate about how we know whether these things are meaningful. Is it meaningful only if an online consultation has an identifiable outcome? Is it meaningful only if the outcomes are better in some measurable way? Is it important that you can show that these consultations actually change the agenda of what decision-makers are thinking about? Is it enough that the public actually feels more consulted, whether or not their specific impacts are traceable to their contributions? What if these things just contribute to public knowledge? What if they just raise public awareness of issues or indeed of how the White House works or anybody else who's conducting these investigations? Decision makers, the public may not think this is great, but decision makers may think that this actually helps in their work in a variety of ways. Or maybe there are other impacts that we could figure out how to measure, impacts on other kinds of civic involvement or social capital. In other words, now that I've had the experience of petitioning the government in this way, am I more or less likely to vote? Am I more or less likely to attend a public meeting about something? I don't think there's any consensus about this. I was at one session where Stephen was asked, that is Stephen Coleman was asked, could he point to any consultation that had actually produced an outcome that would not otherwise have occurred? And he said, you know, that's tough, although he had one, which I mentioned because it's partly, it's a good story, in which is that Parliament apparently in the UK ran an online consultation in which people could participate anonymously, basically on the policies surrounding shelters for victims of domestic violence. And a number of people participating in that forum commented that the move to a shelter was more traumatic for themselves and for their kids because they couldn't bring family pets. Animals were disallowed by the then existing policies. And because of that consultation, the rule was changed. And this is a sort of dramatic story because, of course, it's quite unlikely that had that consultation be held in any other way, that is, either requiring face-to-face participation or participation by name, that kind of public input would not have occurred. And it may very well not have occurred to people operating the shelters to change their policies. Okay. Well, I'm glad to have all kinds of democratic participation. So I've only started to sort of think about this latest Obama effort, and I'm hoping that I've given you enough to think about in terms of advising me on how we should move forward, what are the important questions here, investigative methods, give up all hope, ye who walk the halls of democracy or forge ahead. And with that, I'll just say thank you. And this is a picture of the group that wrote the book, A Meeting in Paris. So, you know, academic life, not so hard. Thanks. So does it fall to me to be the caller of... Okay, well, I saw your name. I saw you first.
Thank you. Very helpful. My underlying question under all this is, how did they decide on that process? How did they decide on those thresholds? How did they decide to give people a certain level of participation that was already preformed? How did they decide? Why did they decide not to do what you would do in a company if you were launching a product?
Which is
to get the people who really know what they're doing together and say, here's what we're trying to solve, here's the stuff you have. Now come up with multiple ways to transform those things into useful things.
Right.
I don't sense that. It may be there. That's why I'm asking.
Sure. So, you know, I don't have a lot of inside knowledge. I was doing some consulting at the FCC at the time that they were thinking about doing this, and they were implementing their first steps. And again, so I have no idea if this is similar to the thought process at the White House or the thought process that anybody else goes through. A couple of things were pivotal at the FCC. So the sort of chief operating officer for the Federal Communications Commission is called the managing director. The managing director was a guy named Steve Van Roekel. He's now the federal CIO in the White House. But Steve is a former Microsoft executive, a brilliant strategist and knower of things technological, and manager of people. And he had brought with him the team of new media experts, I think, you know, all of whom were under 25, from the Obama campaign. I should say he and Julius Chenikowski, his chair, kind of scooped them up. So they had a lot of that field experience already, and I think their view was we have to do something immediately. That is, we can't have a long sort of crank-up process. By this time, you know, there were tools sort of commonly being used, and so their basic task was both to kind of adapt them in ways that kind of seem sensible just from the point of view of discussion process, but also they have to be sensible in terms of addressing the anxieties as well as the enthusiasms of people on the inside. So I think there is that process, but. You know, your question does highlight a kind of ongoing concern, which is for this, I think many of us would say, for this to be a deeply meaningful experience, these forums have to be created in circumstances that generate trust. Is it, does it make trust impossible if the site is itself not organically generated, but comes from government?
Structured early.
Yeah. I think you were next. I'm sorry I'm pointing. I just don't remember everybody's name going around the table.
So I guess my first question, which I'll explain why I'm asking, is of the 45 responses over 4 months, do you know how many of them only reached the 5,000? How many of them would not have made it if there were a 25,000 person response? And the reason I'm asking is I actually got a response to an 8,000, 9,000 person poll. So I'm curious whether by setting it at 25,000, they're basically saying, look, we have this great resource, but we actually don't want to spend the time responding to people.
Right. So I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know how many have hit the 25,000 threshold yet. But
I mean, 45 in 4 months isn't a huge amount to my mind in terms of representative democracy in big issues. I mean, just so I'm sort of curious, are they trying to get it down to 3 or...
I don't know the answer. Yeah. The one thing I can say, now, again, all petitions that are on the site, of course, are visible to everyone, and they remain up there even after they've been responded to, or even if they're not responded to, as long as they get the thresholds of names. So, you know, they could still conceivably be useful informational or mobilizing devices, even if they don't get the White House response. But, you know, whether 45 is a lot or a little probably depends on... where you stand in the time management process. I think you, and then you.
Do you know if there was anything in the content of some of the early petitions that caused them to raise the quota? Were they getting stuff that they thought was, you know, inappropriate or crackpot? Or?
Again, I don't have inside knowledge, but I don't think so, because the terms of service already allowed them to moderate that sort of thing off the site. So I have no reason to suspect it was anything other than what they suspected was the impending volume of petitions.
I heard one anecdote on this,
okay,
that the leading petition, the first iteration of the site, was one to legalize marijuana. Right. And so that's why they then upped the numbers. And
but there was a response to that.
How far did they get with the numbers?
I don't remember the numbers, but that was my understanding of why they raised.
I suspect that would have hit the higher quota, too, if it had been necessary to do so. Mm-hmm.
Well,
anecdotally, the response to the 9,000 petition didn't seem really well researched, or it was mostly, well, we made up our minds, so we're really not interested in.
Well, this is so. Maybe I should repeat this in case it's not being picked up in the webcast. So the question is, again, and this goes to the question I posed on the slide. You know, whether this is meaningful, and I don't mean to. I should say, from my point of view, anything that habituates people to the idea that they're entitled to make demands on the government is a good thing. Having said that, it's easy. You can look at these responses and say these petitions are not action generating. That the responses are so far have been consistently of the kind we share your concern. We're glad that you wrote us, and either this is consistent with what we're already doing, or we have proposed, you know, our own steps to respond to this, or, you know, we disagree or can't respond for legal or other reasons. And if the measure of impact is, oh, I can show that my petition really got them to rethink an issue or reframe an issue that they hadn't understood in this way, I think it's fair to say that evidence of that has not yet been produced. You know, whether it's too early to reach a verdict based on 45 petitions, that's another question. Yes?
Well, my question also gets at whether it's meaningful, but in a different way. We've been talking a lot about the outputs of the petitions, but I'm wondering on the input side, a little bit of background to contextualize. So I went to Stanford, and I actually took Jim Fishkin's class called The Dialogue of Democracy last winter quarter.
Oh, great.
And in that class, we talked a lot about the importance of a representative sample.
Yes.
So that the decision and the deliberation has legitimacy to the broader population.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering whether there's been any attempt to study what kinds of people are submitting these petitions online, how representative they can be taken. Because if it's just really policy elites who are submitting the questions, you could argue that it's just providing a new kind of echo chamber rather than empowering a broader base of citizens to actually participate.
Right. So what you just stated is a very serious concern. And again, I'm going to restate it mainly just to make sure it gets over the microphone. So people who self-select to participate in a forum structured this way may or may not be representative of the public. It may be that, as you said, it may be some slice of a political or technological elite that's participating. And if so, it's a decent question of democratic theory whether we want it to be influential or what the impact will be. So the answer to your first question is, I think we don't know, certainly with regard to these federal initiatives, the answer to the question of who's participating. At least I don't, and I have not yet talked to people to find out if there's a way of accessing that information. My guess is that it would not be easy to do. Having said that, you could imagine structuring this kind of initiative in a way that would make it possible to see who was participating. I think it would be valuable to know. So you mentioned that Professor Fishkin's main preoccupation in this has been the importance, as he sees it, of having a representative sample. And so let me just say a little more about the model of deliberative polling for people who have not been imbued with this yet. So the idea of a deliberative poll is some sponsoring organization. It could be a provincial government in China. It can be a national level government. It can be a local government. Has some question. Should we tax commuters from the suburbs? Should we build an airport? It could be anything. The way the process ordinarily works is, if you ask for Professor Fishkin's help, he will assemble a kind of stakeholders committee, people with very divergent contesting stakes in this, to be a kind of steering committee. And they oversee a process for the assembly of briefing materials. And the briefing materials are supposed to be fairly representative of pretty much a full range of positions on whatever the issue is. So, and people on the steering committee, you can't object to anybody else's position, but you do get to say, my position has or has not been fairly presented. Okay, so once these briefing materials are assembled, then you call people in a kind of randomized telephonic poll. Of course, there are limitations there also. Some people don't have telephones, but it is as representative as, say, a Gallup poll would be or some other kind of poll. And people are surveyed on a set of questions, and then they're invited to participate in a face-to-face deliberation on the question that is conducted on a subsequent weekend. And so the group of people who volunteer, so they're also somewhat self-selected, but it's possible to compare them demographically to the larger group of people who've been consulted over the telephone, so you can get some sense of whether they've been skewed at all. That group then deliberates. They reach a conclusion after several stages of discussion, and that conclusion represents a kind of well-educated opinion from a genuinely representative sample. This is, I think it's a great model, except that it is very labor-intensive, and however much labor is involved in actually getting a few hundred people together to do this, there is yet more labor involved in amplifying or broadcasting the nature of the project and what people have done in it so that it has a larger kind of information multiplication effect than just making 300 people feel good about participating in the process. My own view is I would love to see, and I've argued in a number of contexts, actually I have an article coming out in a couple of months in a journal called IS, a Journal of Law and Policy for the Information Society, that's published out of Ohio State University, a journal that argues for using deliberative polling to help make national cybersecurity policy. But it's not necessarily the model I would use for everything, because it may be that there are other objectives that other models serve more easily, the obvious model being political mobilization. That is, it may be that what you really want to do is get as many people who are potentially excited about something excited about it quickly, and that is a justification in some cases for having some kind of self-selected poll. Boy, I hope Jim isn't watching. He'll hate that I said that. But my only point is that different kinds of communication experience have different roles to play in democratic information flow. That's sort of a very long-winded answer to your question.
That's on a lot of the issues. I didn't mean to suggest deliberative polling is like the way to go. I'm just curious how it plays along with
right.
ideas that are entertained online.
Yeah, I would love to see it. And in fact, I've said, you know, people, nobody has yet said to me, and maybe somebody's about to say, what if people don't want to do this? You know, what if people would rather watch science fiction or, you know, cook dinner or something? And partly my reaction has always been, you know, we have jury duty. Why can't we have public policy jury duty? I mean, if we think that participating in a democratic communication sphere is important, you know, we draft people for less noble things. Yes?
So just a question about sort of some of the framing. So you were just starting to get to there with this sort of like public participation jury duty thing. Kind of seems at odds with some of the other framing of the conversation so far. Consultation versus participation. Mm. So the consultation frame has some other empowered actor just asking me what I think about an issue and then going off and doing their own thing, versus the participatory sort of idea where I'm actually co-drafting policy or something like that.
Right.
There have been some really interesting examples of that sort of thing recently. There's an Icelandic constitution, which was recent. Well, it's in the parliament right now and under consideration. A new, entirely new constitution, which was drafted in part through public participation with social media tools. There are some other less exciting and less probably likely to succeed initiatives, like the online community Reddit is currently working on a drafted free internet act where it's a bunch of people in that community drafting legislation that they're going to try to get
right.
into their body. And contrasting that with the sort of we the people sort of model, one of my favorite petitions from that one was this, we demand a vapid, condescending, meaningless, politically safe response to this petition. And that sort of mirrors my experience with reading the responses, which to me read a lot more like the same sort of form responses I get every time I've sent a letter to the senator.
Yeah.
I just wonder if you could comment even just like aspirationally in terms of building new tools or developing new structures that use information technology, consultation versus participation.
Right. So it's a great question. And let me say one reason why people who share the interest we've been discussing in online consultation have focused on the federal administrative process is that federal law actually requires agencies that promulgate regulations to take public views into account. Now, it's done, it's a kind of subtle requirement in a way, but those of you who are in or have been to law school know that when an agency promulgates a regulation, it can be set aside if a court regards it as arbitrary and capricious, the language of the Administrative Procedure Act. And one ground for finding a regulation arbitrary and capricious is that in developing the rule, the agency failed to respond to significant issues that were brought to its attention through public comment. Now, that's not a requirement that, you know, a poll be taken or even that the agency respond to the public commenter in a way that would accord with the sentiment of the public commenter. But it would typically does mean something more than we hear you, thank you for your comment. If it is a significant issue and the agency are not going in the direction of that comment, you would at least have to explain why. That, to me, has always seemed a perfectly reasonable model to expect authorized institutions to follow who are setting up public consultations. That is, I find it hard to imagine that governing institutions, certainly at the national level in the United States, are going to bind themselves to outcomes of participatory processes. But I could imagine, and I think it's a reasonable demand, that agencies be asked to set up consultative processes to which they have to respond in a way that is meaningful to a third-party referee. So it may be that even for the White House petitions, I mean, this is not going to happen, but if those White House petitions were subject to judicial review, the answers would be better, even if they still took the form of, we're not actually going to do what you ask. So I think those are sort of the key features. There has to be a kind of commitment to meaningful response and probably, you know, some enforcer of that. Yes. Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to add on to a question. I think I have a question in a similar vein. I think you raised some great dynamics that are taking place, or tensions taking place between anxiety within government and enthusiasm within kind of the broader population to participate in the policy process. And in terms of who's doing that participation, I was wondering what you thought about the participation or the creation of things like civic commons, where you have coders or kind of off-duty geeks and hackers who look for data sets coming out of municipal governments and are able to create apps or create tools to actually observe what's taking place in those governments. And how do you think what do you think the responses have been of those municipal governments? Often it's a municipal, and also other people who are part of that ecosystem.
Right. So this is also a great line of inquiry. When the Knight Foundation set up the Knight Commission, they were very anxious that it not be seen as a commission to answer the question, how do we save the old newspaper? But it would be fair to say that among the sources of consternation that led them to create the Knight Commission was what was perceived to be a kind of crisis in the availability of kind of accountability-relevant information, particularly at the state and local level, with the closing of a lot of local and regional papers and the huge downsizing of newspaper staffs and so forth. And one response, so there's obviously a very troubling story to tell about that. And people who are more inclined towards cheerfulness will say, government is, there are a variety of these data sharing initiatives in which the government is participating in. Certainly, Vivek Kundra, who's here, is a real champion of those initiatives. He's did wonderful things in D.C., wonderful things as the federal CIO, and they continue at a lot of levels. And it is true that a number of agencies, a number of governments kind of sponsor competitions for best apps. There are various kinds of, code for government, code for the people sorts of projects, which are excellent. They do not, I think, substitute for, I think a healthy democratic information ecology has to do a lot of things simultaneously. One is take information wherever it's available and translate it into accessible forms. And I take it that's what a lot of these apps are doing, and that's great. But contextualizing that information, turning it into kind of community understanding, is not going to happen on the smartphone. So it's interesting. I'm teaching a seminar this semester called The Future of Media in the Digital Age, and one question we're going to be talking about in 2 weeks is whether these transparency initiatives can help address the journalism crisis by making it kind of less expensive to do accountability journalism. I think it's great, but I don't think it's going to lessen the need for journalism. It's going to increase the need for journalism. When I told, I gave a talk, my home base is Ohio State University. When I gave a talk in Columbus to people from city government about things that other governments were doing with social media, and I mentioned that the FCC was now sharing all these data, the person who was in charge of social media said, "Oh, great, another mountain of information I can't possibly digest." So this is the problem. I mean, we are now awash in more information, but that information only creates the need for more intermediaries, not fewer. Okay. Yes,
so Rob. One ill-formed thought, which is probably more of a comment than a question, but I'll try to end it with a question mark, which is that...
you can do upspeak.
we kind of take it as an act of faith that more participation is better. And I'm not sure that's always true. I think it's more true to say that better participation is better, and that quickly devolves back to where we started from. So I get confused as to what metrics are in this that we could actually hang a hat upon. And I think you allude to that, but maybe you could say more about that.
Sure.
And I'll let you have a crack at that.
Okay.
The other question is, are there some shining examples where petitions have worked? Often these things are led by anecdote. And what are the great anecdotes to say, hey, there's some real potential here? Here's an issue that got turned around because 25,000 people sent in a petition and we ended up with demonstrably better public policy as a result.
Right. So on that second question, to be honest, you know, I don't have that catalog. I don't know if there are these shining examples. There's a chapter in the book. Do you know one?
Do you know about Brazil? Brazil's attempts to consult? There's a whole series of consultation of local citizens in Brazil. It's actually been much more successful. I can't cite specifics, but it's interesting.
Well, my consultant from Brazil, Ivar Hartman, is at the end of the table.
Yeah.
But is this? But we're not.
Not the point here. We're focusing on American system.
No, I'd be very happy with an example for Brazil or anywhere. But I think so. And they're different realms here. So I think participatory policy making is a very different thing than petitions. And so there's different realms of this.
Well, so again, so let me address your two questions in this way. As I posed the question on the last slide, there's a lot of debate about what the appropriate metric is for investment. You know, what return on investment would or should persuade a government to devote resources to this? And you've suggested that the case might be made yet more persuasively if we could show, you know, specific petitions that have led to specific outcomes that would not otherwise have occurred. And my sense is, from talking to my European friends, that there are some examples of that, but you know, whether we can be absolutely sure it wouldn't have happened without the petition, you know, there are all kinds of sort of interpretive questions. As, by the way, there are interpretive questions about petitions in general. I mean, the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances has existed in the United States since 1789, whether we could look at all the anti-slavery petitions before 1860. Did they work? So I think there's a legitimate question about whether, I do think any sensible sense of metrics has to include some sense of the efficacy of these things, but how weighty that is open to question. And I think in asking that, we have to be alert to just how difficult it is to interpret events in that way. The first question you asked was, is more participation always better? And I guess I would say this. I mean, I think at the root of this concern, and now this, I'm reverting to constitutional law guy, not technologist, is one's thinking about democracy and democratic legitimacy. So my own view, which is not at all necessarily a consensus view, or maybe a wholly idiosyncratic view, is that the appropriate question to ask about democratic legitimacy is, what is it that morally entitles a relatively small number of people to tell very much larger groups of people what to do? I mean, that's the legitimacy question. And I think there are some people who operate in this space who would say the answer is elections. And I regard elections as a necessary but insufficient condition for democratic legitimacy. Because it seems to me that for a relatively small group of people to make decisions that bind a lot of other people, two things have to happen. One is the sort of political autonomy thing that we're familiar with as an American ideal, that people get to experience themselves as meaningful political agents, asking for things, participating, voting. But I also think at the end of the day, obviously, we're never going to live in a world in which everybody's happy with every decision, or even that every decision, that the burdens and benefits of all decisions are going to be ideal from, you know, some standpoint of justice. But I don't think it's unreasonable to demand of governing institutions that before they make decisions, all the interests that are potentially affected by the decision at least get taken into serious account. That is, that they get articulated, they get discussed, they get weighed in some meaningful way. And from that point, if I'm right about that, then certainly it would maximize the possibility of the most interest being articulated and weighed if more people participated. That doesn't mean everybody has to participate in everything, but the idea, I think it's a drastic mistake to have only experts participate. And just to point to two areas, I mean, it was lovely to have Susan Crawford here earlier. If Susan were here, you know, I would, I will urge people anyway to read her last column in Wired about what happened with the Light Squared dispute in the FCC. And just generally to look at what's happening with spectrum policy in the United States. Look at the legislation that governs spectrum auctions, something that's going to have a huge impact on the welfare of ordinary Americans and about which ordinary Americans, I would assume, know nothing. That's one. Cybersecurity is another. There is a front page story in the New York Times today about a White House pushback against the National Security Agency for a particular plan to increase cybersecurity by authorizing increased automated monitoring by NSA of internet service providers. And, you know, it may be that there's enough pressure from geek world to sort of keep this operating in a democratic way. But this obviously has huge implications, not only for privacy, but taking the NSA as its word, big implications for security. And the public ought to be aware of that because the impacts will be ubiquitous. So I guess what I would say is, you know, is more participation always better? Maybe not. Would hugely more participation than we routinely have be better? Absolutely. I would take that stand. I think there's probably time for another question. Yes?
I imagine better and worse ways of asking the public to comment on public policy, and I can imagine lots of motivated citizens making comment. It seems to me the weak point is getting government to listen to public comments and to respond with more than a white paper or more than a memo. Are there any success stories or any good ideas in getting governments to listen and to respond meaningfully? For example, you can't expect policymakers or people with actual power to actually read all the memos that come through, all the emails that come through. So if they're read by low-level clerks, what happens to the input? How do we translate meaningful public comment into meaningful government response?
Right. So that's also a great question. Again, I just restated for the microphone. The question is how to translate meaningful public, how to get meaningful public input translated into meaningful government response. One thing that, so as a teacher also of administrative law, I confess shamefacedly, is how little we actually know about the overall operation of the public comment process in the pre-digital world. In large part because to investigate that, to get to those comments, you would actually have to go to the agency office, you know, go through their paper files. Now this stuff at least exists online. People like me have even less excuse for our ignorance because it's possible to research this stuff more easily. But I would say the following. I mean, agencies, now that we're moving to electronic comment world, are turning to electronic tools for a couple of things. One is just response sorting. So agencies typically now will have a tool that will tell them whether 10,000 comments are actually the same comment, so they don't have to read it over and over again. So if there's a rule on polar bear protection, you know, there will be a lot of the same comment generated presumably by the Sierra Club or the National Wildlife Federation. So they can use technology to kind of see how many actual comments they have. And there are also tools available that help at least sort them into subject matter areas so that they can assign a group of memos, a group of comments about the same thing to a staff member whose job would be to summarize them for higher level decision makers. my sense is that if we were to do this, we would probably find a great many proposed regulations that in some detail or other were changed because of public comments, that an agency realized that something that they thought would be easy to implement would be much harder to implement, so they slowed down the required implementation schedule, or they may have changed some other features of this. But to be honest, it's never been done in a kind of quantitatively rigorous way. So as an administrative law person, I wish I could tell you that it's our national experience that 4 out of every 10 rulemakings experiences a significant change at the agency level in response to public comment. But we actually don't know. We didn't know before this stuff went online, and we still don't. One more? Sure, absolutely.
And that, which is, I think you've rightly identified the interface between civic engagement and representative government as kind of the sweet spot there, and also the area of confusion here. When you talked about legitimacy of government, well, our governmental system is representative, and the legitimacy is whether the people that we've elected are actually representing our interests or not, and how this kind of civic participation would actually influence that. And I hope it's the fact that some of these kinds of ideas could bubble up and get to them, but I'm skeptical of that as well. I mean, we need to convince our congressmen to do the right thing for our interest, which is a hard thing to do. The other point is that we think about the federal level a lot in these things, but it's probably more promising in many ways the more local and more granular you get, the interface between civic participation and governance is a lot closer at those levels as well.
Right. Yeah. I think you made two very important points, and just on the first one, I just want to say, you used a very important word with which I completely agree, and I think James Madison would as well. You said that representatives are there to represent our interests. Our interests may or may not be our opinions. And at the risk of a presidential candidate, accusing me of snobbery, I want to insist that becoming informed about one's interests may be a complicated process. The second thing that you said about localism, I think, is absolutely true. And one of the things I actually think the federal government could do that might be among the most important contributions to this process is creating tools that could easily be used by local government, because I do think for these things to have my sense is that online initiatives typically have the most traction if they interact with face-to-face opportunities for communication as well. And so if we could do that at the local level, but local governments very often just don't, they don't have the IT staff of the Berkman Center, much less of, the federal government or a federal agency. So any help like that could be powerful. I thought I saw one last hand over here. Yes.
Well, the other problem is one that innovators and researchers face, which is the people judging the work aren't as good as the people suggesting the work. And there's a real capacity problem. When you have an administration that turns over, and they're not used to being an effective team, so turf wars break out, and that's a drag on the system. And you have them with computer systems that aren't state-of-the-art. The size of some of the mailboxes is astoundingly small. They're actually kind of crippled when it comes to technology. And so things that they find really hard to do, because that's the environment they're in, it's not really as hard outside the walls there.
Yeah.
So, in other words, there are multiple benefits to inviting different subject matter experts of different generations to come together and start to set standards and say, really, you're doing that this way now? We used to do it this way, and it was simpler, and it worked when the power went out.
Yeah.
And I don't hear that cross-pollination going on, and so, I was wondering if you have.
Yeah. Well, I'm very aware of the difficulty that you're citing. And in a way, I mean, what the FCC tried to do was sort of bring in the experts of the multiple generations in just the way that you suggested. You know, it's hard to use the word nonpartisan here other than as a, in our day and age, other than as a punchline. But one yearns for a kind of, nonpartisan trans-administration information technology expert core of some kind, so that you know these wheels do not have to be invented perpetually. And I will say, I mean, one doesn't want to stereotype any group unduly, and so I don't want to necessarily say all IT people think alike either. But I do think that there is, within the community, a certain predisposition towards openness, which, at least in a lot of settings, that is useful to bring to government. So one of the things, so I feel compelled to end on a good news story. So beginning in the Reagan administration, the White House started a process of centralized oversight of federal regulations. That is, a federal agency that proposes a regulation, if it's going to have a significant impact on the economy, now has to send it to OMB for to have their cost-benefit analysis kind of refereed. And people who were concerned that this was being used to short-circuit health and safety regulation demanded of the Reagan administration that they let people know where in the process a proposed regulation was stuck. And the Reagan administration claimed executive privilege successfully over that information. They said, we don't have to tell you, and we're not going to tell you. So when Clinton took office, he revised the executive order under which this happens to make that information public. But it was the George W. Bush administration that put it online. And the people, you know, my guess is if you ask the people who were responsible for that initiative at OMB during the Bush administration what they thought of government transparency, and you ask the people working in the Obama White House, they would be reading off exactly the same page. But, you know, what can I say? That's not everybody, but if we had some way of maintaining access to that talent, it would be a very good thing. Platform for talent. Yeah, one of those. Thank you so much for your attention. This is great.